Lecture 6, Egypt under the early Ptolemies.
Welcome back to our sixth lecture now in the series on the Hellenistic Age. So far our story has involved Alexander and his conquests, but we've seen that with his death in 323, the Hellenistic world, the empire that he had conquered, which extended across the Near East all the way to India, was really plunged into turmoil because none of Alexander's successors was capable of maintaining the kind of unified empire that he had created. Partly because, as we saw, none of them were interested in the kind of policy of cultural fusion which Alexander had promoted, at least in the upper echelons of his empire, between Greeks and Persians. Instead, we've seen emerging in the void after his death and after a generation of civil wars, a new political landscape in which the Hellenistic world is broken up into great regional and dynastic blocks. And it's those that we're now going to start to examine a little more closely. The first of these, the one about which we have the most information and probably the most famous then, is that of Ptolemaic Egypt. We've seen that Ptolemy was one of Alexander's bodyguards. We've seen that Ptolemy very cunningly realized upon Alexander's death that Egypt was the one province or satrapy of the Persian Empire which could be most easily maintained on its own, hermetically sealed off, if you like, from the rest of the Mediterranean and the rest of the world. And so it was to Egypt that Ptolemy took himself, transforming himself in the course of his career from bodyguard and general of the Macedonians to satrap of the now dead and departed Alexander, until finally by the end of his career he was a pharaoh. Once again the manifestation of the power of God on earth, at least as far as his Egyptian audience was concerned. In this lecture then, let's look at the way that the Ptolemies administered Egypt and how their dynasty ruled that country for 300 years. Well, I pointed out that Egypt is cut off from the rest of the Mediterranean by desert on two sides, cataracts to the south and the delta to the north. It also has a kind of ethnic and historical unity that goes back thousands of years to the age of the pyramids at least. And so, altogether, these factors created in Egypt conditions for an immensely stable society. Egyptian society was essentially structured like a pyramid. That is to say, the pharaoh was on top, supported underneath by a priestly scribal class, which relied on the pharaoh for their power, and in turn, the pharaoh, his family, and the scribal class, the priestly class, then depended upon the work of the vast majority of peasants living in the Nile Valley. What I'm going to suggest is that Egypt is a good place for examining how Hellenism really works, because what we're going to find, I think, is that the Greeks and Macedonians only replace the top level of that pyramidically, hierarchically organized society. Ptolemy will replace the pharaoh or the Persian provincial governor, and a Greco-Macedonian elite will supply the upper echelons of the hierarchy that rules this country, but the priests will continue to offer a great deal of stability, and they will cooperate with these new Macedonian overlords. And together, those two groups will continue to rule over the vast Egyptian peasantry, for whom Pharaoh, Ptolemy, Persian governor, the differences were negligible. Their lives continued in much the same pattern year after year. So what we find is that the Greeks and the Macedonians are not really interested at all in any kind of cultural fusion between Egyptians and Greeks. And in fact, one of the most heartbreaking documents to come out of the sands of Egypt is a petition written by a man in the Hellenistic period to one of the local officials complaining about the treatment that he's received. And I want to read you the details of this, and then I want you to pay attention to exactly what it is that is the nub of the problem. This fellow, whose name we don't know, the beginning of the letter is broken, writes to Zenon and he says, "I hope you're healthy. I too am well. You know that you left me with Crotos," that's a good Greek name, "and I did everything that was ordered in respect to the camels and was blameless towards you." We don't know exactly what his job was, but perhaps he was a camel driver. "When you sent an order to give me pay, He gave me nothing of what you ordered. When I asked repeatedly that he give me what you ordered and Krotos gave me nothing, but kept telling me to remove myself, I held out for a long time waiting for you, but then I was eventually compelled to run away. Although I did everything that was ordered, and for 9 months now all he's given me is, well, no oil, no grain, except 2 month periods when he also paid for the clothing. This is some sort of allowance. And so our poor complainant says, I'm in difficulties both summer and winter, and he orders me to accept ordinary wine for salary. Well, they have treated me with scorn because I don't speak Greek. Ouk Hellenizdo, I don't speak Greek. This poor man is a native Egyptian. He's dealing with some of the Greeks that have come into Egypt, and because he does not speak their language, they regard him as a barbarian. And so in this instance, they're trying to screw him out of the salary that he deserves. The two groups kept very separate from each other. There was very little intermarriage between the two groups, and we have very full records for Ptolemaic Egypt of documents with both Greek names and Egyptian names. And in the few instances where we do get intermarriage, it is invariably between Greek men, new colonists and officials who are pouring into Egypt, and Egyptian women. There are virtually no instances of Egyptian men marrying Greek wives. Most of the Greeks and the Macedonians who pour into Egypt at this time come in to serve in the Ptolemaic bureaucracy. And they remain separate from the Egyptians over whom they exercise power. This distinction between the two ethnic groups is also mirrored in the relationship between the city of Alexandria and the rest of Egypt. Alexandria, according to its foundation myth, and this is probably vastly exaggerated, Alexandria had been laid out, it was said, by Alexander himself. Now, the fact is, Alexander had planted 70 cities across the Near East. Most of them were probably originally garrisons and trading stations, and it is a matter of just historical change that some of them grew into great cities. Samarkand and so forth. This Alexandria probably began the same way, probably as a trading port on the very tip of Egypt, right up there in the delta, close to the Mediterranean Sea. But it grew into, it was turned into, the capital of the Ptolemaic realm, but it was essentially a Greek city on the outskirts of Egypt. Ptolemies chose not to rule from Memphis or from Thebes, from any of the traditional capitals of the pharaohs that had come before them. And even in the Roman period, when the Romans talked about Alexandria, they called it Alexandria ad Aegyptum, Alexandria next to Egypt. So these Ptolemaic rulers are almost ruling Egypt, almost as absentee landlords, on the very edges, because as good Macedonian Greeks, they're more interested in what's going on in the Mediterranean. That's their realm. That's the realm where their navies operate and their armies operate. Egypt is behind them, and as long as it is a well-run and well-organized system, that's all they care about. In fact, the peasants, the Egyptians living in Egypt, needed permission from their local authorities to enter the city, almost an internal passport, if you will. And so there is a split, I think, in Ptolemaic Egypt between, there's a split almost in the way the Ptolemies see themselves in relation to Egypt. It's a kind of schizophrenia. The monarch, the Ptolemy, has to be a pharaoh to the Egyptians. He must be a pharaoh to maintain all those traditional Egyptian values of mart, of justice and good order. But to his Greek audience, up in Alexandria, he has to be a Macedonian king. And so in this respect, the Ptolemies are negotiating, I would argue, the same kind of difficulty and dilemma that Alexander faced. Only their solution is to keep the two separate and to really behave almost as two separate dynasties. A pharaonic dynasty in Egypt and a Macedonian dynasty in Alexandria. On the great temples of Egypt, such as at Karnak, if you go and look at the presentations of these figures, of these great pharaohs of Egyptian history, I defy you to distinguish Ptolemy I from Thutmosis III, who reigned hundreds of years earlier. In both cases, the Pharaoh will be three times larger than life. He will be seen striding manfully forward to attack his enemies. He will have a war club in one hand, and he'll be holding his enemies by the hair in the other hand, ready to smash their brains. And whether it is 2300 BC or 1300 BC or 300 BC, the same imagery is being used. And frankly, if the audience looking at this was illiterate, as invariably most of the peasants were, they were seeing continuity. Ptolemy was Pharaoh to them, but not to the Greeks. So the Ptolemaic system completely abandoned, I think, Alexander's notion of a policy of fusion. One other element that helped to contribute to the Greek occupation of territory here and to the split between them was simply the annexation of land. In many parts of Egypt, Greek colonists poured in and simply took over the choice land. Now, we happen to have, fortunately, the records of one Egyptian village from the Hellenistic period, a place called Kerkyosiris, where we have quite specific details of how the land was owned. And we know that in this small village, 52% of the land was owned by Ptolemy himself. Now, if that's true across all of Egypt, and it probably is, it means that literally half of Egypt is the king's own private domain. All right? And then, the next largest category, 33%, belongs to the Greek colonists, clerics as they're called. They simply handed over this land, and as we've seen from our letter to Zenon earlier, we can understand how they treated their Egyptian neighbours. That comprises 85% of the land of Egypt, or at least of Kerkyosiris, and I would suggest probably the rest of the country as well. And of the remaining 15%, 6% of that belongs to the temple. So Ptolemy, the Greek colonists, and the Egyptian priests own over 90% of the land around and in this village. And the final 9%, that's the land that is actually owned and run by the Egyptian peasants. In other words, that's the land that they live off, that has to supply all their needs. So what we're finding dramatically in this evidence from Kerkyosiris is that the Ptolemaic system is not about fusing Greek and Egyptian. It is about the more thorough and the more complete exploitation of Egypt's resources. Now, Egypt, as I've said, is cut off from the outside world by deserts and cataracts, and therefore it's possible to minimize the outside influence on Egypt. And as a result of that, it is a perfect place to be hermetically sealed and to be treated, as it was by the Ptolemies, as a cash cow. Now, they took their exploitation of Egypt to phenomenal lengths, and I want to chart some of these for you to give you an idea of exactly how Ptolemaic rule operates in Egypt. First of all, Mediterranean merchants who wanted to come to Egypt because it was so fertile and it supplied so much grain to the Mediterranean basin had to conduct all of their commerce with the king's agents, so that anything being exported from Egypt essentially went through the king's warehouses. And he took a cut at every level on the contracts, on the storage costs, on the produce itself, stamp duties, everything. Every bit of money that could be extracted from this system was. Now, one of the ways that the Ptolemies controlled this trade was in this way. International transactions around the Mediterranean involving merchants moving goods backwards and forward were conducted in silver and gold coinage. Now, the real weight of that coin attested to the value of the Ptolemaic economy. It was a sign of good faith because they had real bullion that they could use for their trade. But within Egypt itself, gold and silver did not circulate. The peasants never got to see any of that coinage. They got to use copper coinage, which was worthless outside of Egypt. So that even in their monetary economy, no Egyptian would ever be able to make any money out of trade. All he could do was barter with other Egyptians and maybe the king's agents. So private commerce then could really never develop in Egypt. The Ptolemaic economy is really like a Stalinist planned economy, with complete control exercised by the crown. Now, the Ptolemies enjoyed monopolies in all the major export-producing crops, so that various kinds of oil, olive oil, linseed oil, various grains that were produced, staples that could be grown in abundance through the Nile Valley and exported through the Delta to the Eastern Mediterranean, these were all tightly controlled by the central monopoly under the authority of the Ptolemy. The monopolies were therefore not confined just to the sale of produce, but to every aspect of its production. And this is really well documented as a result of many papyri found in the sands of Egypt. And we know from these papyri that the king's agents determined everything from when the land was to be sown. They distributed the seed that was to be sown. They monitored closely the actual use of tools to be used in the production of any of this produce. They announced the time of harvest. It was they who arranged for the storage and transportation of all of this produce back to Alexandria, and they stamped everything to show that they had recorded it, and it was all copied out in triplicate. We have astonishingly detailed instructions involving this, and I'd like to read you just a few details of this. They get to be pretty boring after a while, so I won't read you too much, but I want you to pay attention to the astonishing detail of the control of the economy by the Ptolemies. This is from a series of documents dating to the middle of the 3rd century, and they involve the revenue laws, as they're called. These are the instructions issued by Ptolemy Philadelphus in relation to various monopolies that I've been talking about. This is quite amazing. We read in this document, in this papyrus, "Those who own implements for making wine shall register with the manager of the farm." When, and then there's a gap. "And when they are about to make wine, they shall exhibit the seal placed on them to show it is intact." So they have to produce a seal to show that all the vessels that they've been given and what they produce is still intact. "Anyone who fails to register or to produce his implements in accordance with the law, or to bring them for sealing when the farmer wishes to seal them," in other words, when they're finished with their winemaking implements, such as a press, for example, a wine press, "anyone who does that shall pay forthwith to the tax farmers the amount of the loss they estimate they've made." So even if you've got a little bit of land and you're growing just a few vines on it and you're going to produce some wine, you have to get your press, your wine press, and the pruning shears from the king's agent. And you have to sign for those, and there is a seal put on them, and you've got to have that seal when you come back. Otherwise, you get charged for it as well. This is really what we would call micromanagement. Down to the very last detail of the economy, the whole thing is being handled by the Ptolemies. Every aspect of production, therefore, was overseen by this Greek bureaucracy that reached all the way from the court in Alexandria down to a slew of local officials. We have, for example, a letter which comes from the chief economic official up in Alexandria, known as the Dioiketes. And he's sending this regulation or this letter down to the local governor further south. And he says to him, "You must inspect the canals and the water conduits which run through the fields and from which the peasants are accustomed to take water to the land cultivated by each of them. And you have to see whether the water intakes into them had the prescribed depth." This is incredible. In the little canals running from the Nile out into the fields, these Greek officials have to go and measure the depth of the canal to make sure it's deep enough for the water into the fields. "In your tours of inspection, try in going from place to place to cheer everybody up and put them in better heart." I'll bet people loved hearing that. "And not only should you do this by words, but also if any of them complain to the local officials about any matter touching it, you should make inquiry and put a stop to such things as far as possible." Now, what this note puts us in mind of is the fact that the Ptolemaic system was so thoroughly exploitative and so carefully managed that it necessarily resulted in a great deal of resistance. The most common category of document that we get from Ptolemaic Egypt is the petition, the complaint, by some poor peasant who is being hard put upon by people who are oppressing him. Here's an example of one such document. It's a complaint about the owner of a lodging, And the complainant writes directly to Ptolemy. Go to the top. I doubt that Ptolemy ever read this, and I'll explain why in a minute. But the letter reads, "To King Ptolemy, greetings from Bithus, one of the veterans of Cardenas. You gave to us, O king, a lodging with the other colonists so that we might not be wronged by anyone or have to pay for lodging. But Hellanicus has forcibly entered the house. He's demolished the wall of the courtyard and moved in. Now, I earlier submitted a petition to you, O king, about these matters, which was transmitted to the general, but the man is still unwilling to give it to me and continues to insult me. I beg you, therefore, O king, if it seems right to you, to write and to fix this matter. May I obtain justice." So every little complaint, imagine if you had a tenant in your house and you were trying to get rid of them. Would you write to the President of the United States? This is what's going on in Egypt. And the reason why I think that Ptolemy never got the letter is because at the bottom of the document, written in another hand, is the note put down by the scribe who finally received this petition. "Agenor to Timoxenus, greeting. I've sent you a copy of the petition that came to me from this fellow. If it was assigned to him, assign to them their shares in accordance." In other words, the Ptolemaic bureaucratic system was wonderfully devised to allow people at the bottom to write to the top so that people at the top could write back down to the local officials and say, look into it. And we quite literally have archives in which over the space of more than a generation or two, people write dozens of letters and clearly get no redress whatsoever. The system isn't concerned with justice. It's concerned with an efficient exploitation of all the economic resources. Every aspect of production, then, is overseen by a Greek bureaucracy. We know of local officials, we know of local mayors, we know of local policemen, we know of local scribes, and virtually all of these are Greek. In fact, these petitions are all written in Greek, which means that those that came from the Egyptian peasants were not being written by them directly, they were going to the local scribe and paying to have their petition put into the language of the Greeks. This controlled economy relied on treating the laoi, as the Greeks called them, the peasants, just as the pharaohs had done, in exactly the same way. But it also required the complicity of the temple estates, the great priestly families, particularly those of Memphis. Now, the Egyptian priestly class was for the most part protected by the Ptolemies. And clearly here the Ptolemies thought about what it was that was needed to make the system run smoothly. The priestly class, the scribes and the priests who ran the old religion, were given the same rights and privileges that they had had during the earlier pharaonic period. They were given large parcels of land and they were able to live freely off its produce. And in turn, and this is really a contractual arrangement, what they then did was to acknowledge successive pharaohs just as their rights were acknowledged by successive pharaohs. Particularly in the second and first century, as the Ptolemies grew weaker and weaker, we find that some of the most remarkable and some of the lengthiest inscriptions to come to us from the Ptolemaic world are inscriptions that show negotiations between the priests and the central authority. Because, of course, every time a Ptolemy was weak, his priests would gouge more land, more prerogatives, and more rights out of him in return for their support. In fact, probably the most famous document in all of Egyptian history, the Rosetta Stone, a trilingual inscription, which was the first inscription that allowed us to actually translate Egyptian hieroglyphics, is in fact a Ptolemaic document. It dates to 196 BC. It comes from the reign of Ptolemy V, and what that document contains in it is a series of tax breaks. Now, it's an excruciatingly long document. I wouldn't begin to read you the details of it, but what it shows is that this young, weak king was relying on the support of the Memphite priesthood in order to maintain his authority in his kingdom. Now, I've painted a fairly bleak picture of the Ptolemaic control of Egypt so far, intentionally so. It was a top-heavy control exercised by a Greco-Macedonian elite, to be sure. But there are a couple of other elements that we should throw into the mix here, because the Ptolemies did, in some ways, attempt to make their power more acceptable or more palatable to their Egyptian subjects. Probably the most curious practice in this regard a practice which seems to be designed to gain legitimacy for the Ptolemies in the eyes of their Egyptian subjects, is the practice of incestuous marriage within the Ptolemaic dynasty. Ptolemy II, the son of the founder of the dynasty, in 275 BC married his sister Arsinoe. And they were known throughout the rest of their joint reign as the Theoi Philadelphoi, that is to say, the brother and sister loving gods. And they'd already claimed this status for themselves. But what does this marriage mean, and how would it work with its different audiences? Well, some Greek gods had been regarded as living in incestuous relations. The father of gods and men, Zeus, was married to his sister Hera, yes, but in ordinary Greek practice, the idea of marrying your sister was certainly regarded as disgusting. And in fact, we have some amazingly disgusting poems written at the time about Ptolemy marrying his sister and presumably having sexual relations with her. This offended most of the Greeks. But it probably was designed to play to an Egyptian audience. In the Egyptian pantheon, at least in late Egyptian religion, two of the most important gods had been Isis and Osiris, and these were regarded as both husband and wife and brother and sister. So this practice of marrying one's sister, which took place amongst the Ptolemies and was continued by later members of the dynasty, was probably an attempt on their part to cast themselves in the role of the living embodiment of Isis and Osiris, the chief mother and father god within the Egyptian pantheon. That may have been their intention. It certainly offended the Greeks, and I don't know that it ever persuaded any of the Egyptians. Nevertheless, the practice continued for essentially 300 years. Even Cleopatra VII, the famous Cleopatra who we'll be talking about at the end of these lectures, was for a time married to her own brother, Ptolemy the 13th. The other attempt that was made by the Ptolemies to try to bridge some of the gap between Egyptian culture, the culture of the conquered, and their own culture, was in the creation of a new religious cult. And this is really a bizarre story. It was a religious cult that was based on the figure of Serapis. And Serapis himself is a figure who is a synthesis of both Osiris from the Egyptian pantheon and the Apis bull, which had gained in respect in later Egyptian history. So these two figures have already been put together, Osiris and Apis, and then they're treated now by the Greeks as a new god called Serapis. But this god is really very un-Egyptian in appearance. We have statues and busts of this god Serapis, and he looks really very much like Zeus and Asclepius and even to some extent Apollo. So it looks as if we have a figure which is in some ways recalling Egyptian religion but is also geared towards Greek religion. And in fact, we even know that Ptolemy II, who was responsible for the creation of this cult, actually imported Greek priests from Greek cities to come to Egypt and to write a liturgy. In other words, to write the hymns and the poems to be recited in honor of this god. So it represents a very curious fusion, because all the trappings and all the external appearance of it is really Greek, and yet the central figure is borrowed from the Egyptians. And some have argued that because of this packaging, if you will, it's not really designed for an Egyptian audience at all, but rather it's designed for those Greeks who are fascinated by everything Egyptian. And that may well be true, because the fact of the matter is that in the Ptolemaic period, even though the worship of the Apis bull remained quite a powerful religious presence in the Egyptian world, the cult of Serapis and the cult that went with it, that of Isis, now presented as a Greek goddess, these two cults were actually much more popular outside of Egypt. In fact, they were really the most successful export of the Ptolemaic Egyptian dynasty. A cult that was a repackaged version of pseudo-Egyptian religion designed for a Greek audience. Now, the Greek world in the Hellenistic period was as fascinated by Egypt as we are still today. They also looked at the pyramids and thought that these were strange and wonderful monuments. And the Greeks had for hundreds of years thought that Egypt was the ancient fountain of all wisdom. So it may be that what the Ptolemies were doing in this cult of Serapis and the cult of Isis was tapping into that awe, that respect, that veneration that the Greeks felt for the Egyptians. Tapping into that and now appropriating it for themselves, so that what had been Egyptian now became Ptolemaic.